Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. The weekend comes, my cycle hums, ready to race to you. These days are
well, I don't have to tell you what that song is or what that theme song is from. You all know it. I don't care how old you are. We all know the theme song from Happy Days, which was just one of the great classics, top shows of its day. It's still in reruns. You can see it all the time. Young, old, all of us so love that show. And what a treat it is for me now to be able to chat with Mrs. C, with Marion Cunningham, the mom of the Happy Days clan, for a good reason, because she just published a new book called My Days, Happy and Otherwise. And sure enough, in real life, not every day can be happy. But it's such a pleasure to welcome Marion Ross to the podcast. Marion, good to talk to you.
Oh, thank you, Paul. I'm so happy to talk to you.
I get to call you Marion and not Mrs. C or anything, right?
Well, it's funny, when we're putting the show together, they said, what should we call you? I guess we'll just call you Marion. And I said, oh, that's fine, yeah, fine. My part was so unimportant at the beginning. Mostly, all I said was, oh, Howard, you know, and oh, Richie, you're not eating, you know, things like that.
And in fact, that actually, we're going to get to Happy Days, believe me, because I know what you're talking about. And if, you know what, let me just, I'm going to go away from that. But since you said that, there was also a time, right, you were not happy. I'm going right into the meat of some of this because what you said, but you were not happy with your salary. You were going to kind of go on strike, not show up for a reading, thinking that'll show them, they'll never do it to me.
Well, you know, one of the producers, a young man, came to me, caught my eye, and he said, Marion, you're not paid enough. Well, I was so grateful to have the job, you know, because I was divorced. I had two children to raise. I was so grateful, but I didn't care. So then I thought, well, yeah, okay. The other children are getting paid. Okay. So I thought, well, okay. And I had a manager, and she said, you're going to stay out. You're not going to come on Monday. So I didn't come on Monday for the reading, and after a while, Ron Howard called me at home, and he said, Marion, he said, I hear that you're going to be replaced. I said, I'll be right in.
It didn't work. Do you know?
I had to wait a couple years until I was well established and then go again, you know.
You know, I always think of a friend of mine is David Schwimmer, and we've talked a lot. And, you know, he was, you probably know this story, but when some of the Friends cast wanted more money, like Schwimmer, he knew that if any one of them had gone in and asked for a raise, they would have been fired. But he said to his fellow cast members on Friends, if we all go in, they can't fire us all. And it was a brilliant move. And your experience kind of suggests he was probably right.
Well, you see, Ron got, when Henry walked off with the show in his pocket, the bonds, he got whatever he got in salary. Ron had a contract where he got exactly the same thing. So they got the big salaries. Now the rest of the people, but they were getting paid more than me. So anyway, it's so funny. At one time, isn't it funny? I'm forgetting the point, but it was like we wanted to get more residuals. We wanted to get these. Because somebody went and they said, you know, there's all these products out there, and games and toys and things, Happy Days things, and you're not getting any residuals for this. So they got organized, and they said to me, do you want to go with us? I said, sure, whatever you can do, well, I'm with you. And because I had gone to Las Vegas to an event, and here was a big roulette wheel with a whole cast of Happy Days on this thing.
Yeah.
And if you hit a Fonzie, you got a this, and if you hit a Marion, you got something. And I thought, what's that? Ha-ha, who knew about that? So we all held out. We hired a lawyer and you know, just stuck it out until they finally gave us, I guess they gave us each $50,000, something like that.
Well, those were the days when, again, this stuff was kind of new and developing. I mean, back in, listen, just a decade before your show, nobody got residuals for anything, right? I mean, and I've talked with...
Well, these were residuals for the show. This was the product.
No, right. But I'm saying nobody ever thought that way, you know, until it was time to think that way. Hey, let me take you back in time. We're going to come back to Happy Days, but I want people to get to know who you are, because you spell it all out in your book, My Days, and there's just, you know, I know about your later life. I didn't know about your earlier life. You grew up in Minnesota, small town kind of in Minnesota, and what I loved about your background is that's about the last place anybody would think that a Broadway television movie star would come from, but you knew that was going to be your future.
I was from Albert Lea, Minnesota, which is a twin city to Austin, Minnesota. You know where that is, southern Minnesota?
I don't. I know the Twin Cities, but they're different ones.
It's right on the highway there. Lots of people go through there.
Okay.
It's the Wilson. It was the Wilson packing plant, you know? And over next door in Austin, it was the Hormel packing plant.
Ah, okay.
Not that we were involved with the pocket packing business.
Yeah.
But...
You always knew you were going to be a star. I mean, it was an unlikely place to come from, I think.
My mother was a Canadian, Irish Canadian, and I was raised that you can be anything. This is the way I was raised. Then I had a crippled brother. My brother Gordon was a crippled boy. And then I was the second little girl. So I'm the middle child. I got middle child syndrome, crippled brother. I was right from a very young age determined to get some attention, if you don't mind, you know. And I was absolutely driven.
Yeah, but you were raised in a family of great faith, right? Your parents, very religious.
Well, they were Episcopalian. My father was a Presbyterian. We certainly went to church all the time, you know.
And what I love, too, is that the spelling of your name was not the spelling of the name you were given with. You decided that a simple change in the spelling is what you wanted to see on a marquee. I love
right.
that.
That's right, because I got a little prayer book, you know, when you're 12 or you get confirmed, and in gold, my little name on the prayer book, M-I-R-I-A-N, did not look so good with the Ross. So I thought, there, I'm going to change that, you know, because...
I love
I
it.
Have big plans. Yeah, big plans.
People, we all know the television background you have, but I mean, a lot of people may not know. I did because I love so many of the movies you've been in. But your role in the late 50s. I mean, you worked with William Holden, Clark Gable, Doris Day, Gig Young. I mean,
Clark Gable. Yeah.
Yeah, that's just amazing.
It is. And I don't know if you're familiar with the name Noel Coward.
Sure, of course.
Well, my God, if I was in this live production of Blythe Spirit at CBS, and Sir Noel Coward was there himself, and Lauren Bacall, and Claudette Colbert, and the first reading, they said, can you come on Sunday afternoon to a reading we're going to do at Humphrey Bogart's house with Lauren Bacall? And
because it's something we all do on a, we all do that on a Sunday, right? We go to Humphrey Bogart's house.
No Coward will be there and come to their house, and the whole cast is going to be there. Oh, you know, and like the butler came to the door and said, what do you want to drink? You know, so it was, I'm like 25, you know.
I think the
maid should have been English, but they said, he's Noel Coward said, you sound Irish, do it that way.
I love it.
Do it that way. Oh, my God, I passed the test.
Did you find that those stars of those days, because you were young, you were probably starstruck as we all would be. Names like Clark Gable or William Holden, but were they all nice? Did they have attitude? Were they stuck up? Or did you say, no, this is what stars should be. You're nice.
No, they were all pretty fabulous. I was so starstruck, and I would think, why am I so bloody shy? I mean, these men are dating girls my age, somewhere, you know. But I was absolutely awestruck.
Yeah.
Awestruck. I was under contract to Paramount Studios when I was 22.
I'm going to let you go, but I have to say, when you wrote about that in the book, you also wrote, because this surprised me, you said, and I wasn't shocked. In other words, I got this offer from Paramount, and I wasn't shocked because it was my destiny. And I'm reading that in your book, and I'm going, I'd have been stunned. But it just goes to show how dedicated you were.
Yeah, apparently I told, we were having auditions at 20th Century Fox, and then the man died, and then he said, well, I will take you over to Paramount. And apparently I said to my agent, well, this will be just as good.
And I think you were right. And you had a great, and by the way, you write a lot about Operation Petticoat. We have some mutual friends. You were friendly with Dick Sargent back in that day, and I knew Dick in his later life. What a great guy. And he talked, and of course, the lies and whatever that so many people had to live back then, because he was openly gay, whatever, but not then. They had to live a secret life.
Boy, we didn't know. I don't think I knew he was gay. I don't know. It was, you know, right. In fact, he and I went up to Alaska to do a big benefit for the Kennedy family's sports thing. What is it?
With the Special Olympics.
Special Olympics.
Yeah.
For the Special Olympics, and we traveled. And he would make a special point of putting his arm around me, you know, as if he wasn't gay.
Well, he actually, on his resume, and again, we talked about this, he had listed that he was married, and he just told me this was studio pressure. He had to make this stuff up.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. No. Yeah, it's very frustrating for him. But, you know, I understand. Yeah. Well, Noel Coward probably similarly, right?
Oh, Noel Coward, my God. So in fact, that's how I knew about him. I had read his first autobiography that he wrote called Present Indicative.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew all about Noel Coward. I used to go in Albert Lea, Minnesota. I would go in the library and read not only who's who of famous people, you know, and it would have their birth and then another famous. And I think, oh, well, and then what happened? How did that happen? How did you do that? You know, and I would read theater arts magazines, and there were all these schools in New York. Then I found one in Minneapolis, MacPhail School of Music and Drama.
Right.
I got him about 15 years old, and I said to my mother, I could, after the 10th grade, I could go up there for the summer, take care of somebody's children, and take lessons there. And my mother, being the Canadian that she was, said, of course, good idea.
Go do it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep.
One of the things you write about in the book is that in all the films that you were in, and you were in many of them, but you were always very frustrated that you were, these are your words basically, you were pretty much kept on the bench. You weren't able to get a breakout starring role, although the positive news was that even in the movie Airport, although you were given a non-speaking role, thank goodness for that, because that actually is what led to Happy Days.
You're so right. That is so, in fact, it's a good reminder. Sometimes the journey, I had to step way back to take that part in Airport because I was so poor. And we, all of us actors on the airplane, didn't have lines, and we were paid less than actors minimum. My God.
Wow.
And my friends would say, how can you take that part? And I said, I have to take this part. So I took, by stepping way back, take that part, that led step by step to Happy Days.
Edwin, we'll talk about that as well. But first, I want to touch on the fact that you've been on Broadway. Some people may not know you have a Broadway career as well. But what I did not know, I think it was your first role. You played John Wilkes Booth's little sister. Now, that's an unusual role to play. Little Asia, I think, was your name.
Yes, that was for Jose Ferrer.
Ah, okay.
And Jose Ferrer starred and put this whole thing about Edwin Booth, the drama, because Edwin Booth's brother, a great actor, Edwin Booth, his brother was John Wilkes Booth,
yeah,
who shot Lincoln. Okay, so it was not a very good play.
Well, I know I love theater, and I don't remember it, I can tell you that.
No, but by God, we took it to Broadway. And the very next morning, the reviews came out, and it was, not going to happen.
Not
going to fly, no.
And once again, and before we get to Happy Days, your person, what I love about your book, Marianne, is that you're very candid about your life. And your first husband, who was named Effie, this was not an easy life. Alcohol wasn't motivated. You were the motivated one in that couple, but you kind of did everything you could.
Well, I did. I say I didn't understand. I am so blissfully naive, really, you know, that I didn't know about alcoholics. We didn't have alcoholics in my own family, you know. So I stayed married for almost 20 years. By God, you know.
And
meanwhile,
yeah.
Meanwhile, doing what I needed to do.
Well, you also, I also recall that during your marriage, you got pregnant, and this was a little bittersweet for me to read about, although it has a kind of a happy ending. It was with your son.
I decided to have a baby after I came back from Edwin Booth. That was such a terrible experience in New York. Mm-hmm. I came home and I thought, I'm going to have a baby. Now, I'd been married 10 years. I waited a long time.
But you also said when Effie found out, he was not happy. He grew into the role and, of course, loved your son, but he wasn't happy at first.
Oh, no. He said, what have you done?
That's what you needed to hear, right?
I thought we're supposed to say, oh, darling, sit down. Let me get you a cup of
let me get your pickles and ice cream.
So I had to write from the beginning, say, oh, don't worry, darling, you'll be all right. No, I can handle it. Don't worry about it. So I'm such a pathetic soul. I've grown up quite a bit since then.
Yeah. Well, and that marriage ended, but then, and by the way, as you know, my first name is Paul, but my middle name, you'll understand why this struck me, my middle name is Michael.
Oh, is it? You're Paul Michael?
And I have a kid named Matthew. So,
oh, no kidding.
I was kind of, now, of course, our listeners have no idea what I'm referring to, but I'll pass that over to you and you tell them what I'm referring to.
Well, and when I was just turning 60, can you believe it, 60 years old, and I'd been single from 40 to 60, I said, I can't be single, be 60 and be alone anymore. Mm. Very shortly after that, I was in a play, and I met this guy, and he was from Broadway, Mr. Paul Michael, and I kept saying, don't you have another last name? No, his name was Paul Michael, and he was from Broadway. He was in Fiddler on the Roof. He was in Man of La Mancha, all kinds of things, a beautiful baritone, very handsome man with olive skin and blue-gray eyes, black hair. He was purebred Lebanese, Christian Lebanese, smart, God. So we were together then for 23 years.
Yeah, and then he passed away.
And then he passed away. But that's in the book too. Yeah.
Well, it is. You also taught. In fact, he had told you he wasn't feeling well, was going to take a nap. You said that was unusual, and you came in the house and sort of hey, Paul, what's going on? And he wasn't responding.
No. So.
And then he also, as I said,
he'd had a lot of health issues.
Yeah.
I'm such a healthy person. I didn't pay any attention to it. He had a triple heart bypass. There was always something. So I don't believe in being sick. So I don't pay too much attention to that kind of thing, you know. And we just went on. And he was a pretty strong guy anyway. So.
But I want to at least mention that again, because you're very candid about that in the book, and I appreciate that. And that'll take us to Happy Days, which, you know, people that know the show Happy Days, and I'll turn this over to you. I mean, first of all, it comes this love of nostalgia that was going on, Gary Marshall having a real read on that. But before we kind of saw Happy Days, we saw American Graffiti, we saw Grease, and we even saw you in Love American Style. There were a lot of tests before Happy Days made it onto the air.
Exactly. In fact, when we made the pilot, it was a spin-off on Love American Style, we said, we're not sure, but there's a kind of a climate for the 50s right now, so here's a little retainer, and you go off and do something else, and we'll see if we can sell this thing. So I went down to the Globe Theater in San Diego, which is a fabulous theater. Wow. Yeah. And I know all those people, and they had said to me, come home, dear, come home, do whatever you want, or anything. So I said, okay, I see you're going to do Summer and Smoke. I'll do that. And Craig Knoll, who was the head of the theater, said, they all said to themselves, Marion, she is the least Alma Weidmiller, Southern, neurotic, you know, wisp of I'm the least person in the world to play a role like that. But they said, okay, come on home and do it. And I said, well, you're going to have to pay me a little something, you know, because I have to get a babysitter for my children. Good God.
And they did. And so you were so close, such a creative genius, Gary Marshall. I should tell you, I do a show here in Chicago, which is called Broadway in Chicago Backstage.
Yeah.
And the recent show that I've just did, it's been airing now, is on, it's a new Broadway, coming to Broadway on Pretty Woman. And of course, that's co-written by Gary Marshall. So I got to work with his daughter, Kathleen, who kind of stepped in for him when he passed away.
Of course. Yeah. I know they were all back there, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. We just had it here, and we'll have to send you a copy of the show. But anyway, talk to me about Gary and what a genius he was.
And not only that, he was kind. And I can remember early on, I was having trouble with something, and you always think, oh, God, it's my fault. He came to my room and he said, that isn't working for you, is it? You know, let me fix it. And he could take the same bunch of lines, turn them inside out, and kaboom, boom, boom, got them, solved them, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, he also created this softball team for us.
Yeah.
Did you know about
it? I did, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you write about that.
That was another device that kept our show going for 11 seasons,
right?
Because I think they didn't want to give up the team, you know?
Yeah, let's do it. In order to play softball, we're going to have to do this show.
Well, they got to keep this going.
And, of course, you talk about every character, every major character gets their own chapter pretty much in your book. And, of course, you know that's what people wanted to see. There was one that surprised me.
The cast decided to do that. Everybody write a little chapter.
Right. And it's this kind of dialogue that you have. But you did it. But of course, a few of the cast members had passed away, so you couldn't rely on that. But you did surprise me with a little bit. I'm going to actually, I have a little trivia for you, but it depends on how well you, I don't know if you'll know this or not. So if I say to you, my grandmother was in a nursing home many years ago, and in the same nursing home in Chicago area was a guy they used to call the Colonel. Does that mean anything to you?
Nothing. Nothing.
It was Tom Bosley's father. And so in his...
No.
Yeah.
No, I don't know that at all.
And I knew him in his final years. The Colonel, as they called him, lived... he was in the Chicago area, and that's where... And Tom would, I guess, come to see him. But one of the things I was surprised about, and you dish it in the book, when you met Tom Bosley, who he's kind of like another one of those American dad, he wasn't real nice to you.
No, he had won the Tony on Broadway for doing Fiorello, and either he had somebody else in mind or something about me. I just annoyed him, and when I would start a conversation with something off, you know, on the set, you know, idle talk, and I'd say, I would tell a little story, and he would say, "Who gives a shit, man?"
Anyway, can we say that on radio? I don't know. My producer will figure that out.
I don't know if you can.
But you said it in the book. I know you wrote it in the book. So, I mean, it's just it's not how I pictured Tom Bosley. But things worked themselves out, right? Because there was something going on with him.
He's a pretty nice guy, you know. But that was the way he treated me. And I thought there's something I do to him. Yeah.
But you did.
I even went to the shrink during that period.
Really?
I could never find it. So what I did... I finally said, I got some needlepoint, and I thought, I don't think I can sit here and idle talk around because something about me is not working with him.
Yeah.
But to
fix that, because and as I read that, I was kind of disappointed when I, you know, about him. But then as you read on in your book, you clarify there was stuff going on in his life, and you actually end up good friends.
Oh, we were very, very close, yeah. In fact, he would call me and he'd say, where are you going, Kansas? When you do those plays, can you call them and see if I can come down there and go and do some plays down there?
So what was it? You spelled out in the book. What was it that was going on in his life that turned him into kind of a jerk to you?
His wife, he had a beautiful wife that he met on Broadway. She had been a singer-dancer in, I can't think of the name of the show at the minute. And anyway, she became ill in an undiagnosed, noticeable kind of way. So he had all this drama going on at home. We didn't know anything about that. So he was probably tired by the time he got home, I mean, got to work. And then as the years went on, it was discovered that she had a brain tumor and did die.
Yeah. That was so, and it explained. Then he sort of turned nice with you. Yeah, there were some losses.
And then everything was easier for him. And then he met a beautiful, beautiful Patty Carr.
Yes.
And beautiful girl. And married her. And So that was.
And I know you spent time with him. We have another. We have another mutual friend in the form of Anson Williams. Anson has been here at GN. We've sung together. He's been on the pipe. He's quite the businessman and a really cool guy. He kind of got it from day one, right? That's kind of a success story. I almost was going to surprise you and have him call in, but this is your moment. So.
And you sang with him.
Yes.
Oh, wonderful.
On our news, on our morning news. Well, it was sort of a goofy thing, but he's got a good sense of humor.
Oh, yes. He's a lovely guy. Smart, smart businessman. Yeah. So he's been with the Happy Days from the get-go.
Oh, yeah, and embraces it. In fact, I wanted to ask you, there are people who were in classic shows in the 60s and the 50s and the 70s, because they do a lot of autograph shows around, and some are, you know, I'm good friends with some folks around there. There are people who embrace that success that was brought to them, and there's others who very much resent it. You embrace it, and I don't understand why people resent it, because it's why they have the success they've had.
Yes. No, they don't want to be identified with that one role. Well, when you think about Yul Brynner, what do you think of when you think of Yul Brynner?
Well, King of I, right? King and I.
I mean, usually every actor is identified ultimately with one role. So join up, you know.
Yeah, just get with it. Hey, so we know Scott, I'm not going to get political with you, but Scott Baio's this big Trump guy and whatever. What was he like on the set? Was he a nice kid or was he all Trumpy back then?
No. It was his dad who was so Trumpy. Yeah.
Ah.
He's a dad like that.
Scott? Know? Scott?
So.
Well, he is now, too.
I know he is. Yeah. He's my neighbor.
Oh. Yeah,
he's an awful nice guy, but he doesn't seem to have a sense of humor about this.
No.
If he had a sense of humor about this, you know, we'd all leave him alone.
Yeah.
But as it is, it's like, what?
What's going on, Scott? Scott, get with it. Wake up. Well, we'll leave the politics. We'll leave the politics alone. There is the sad story of Aaron Moran, who was lost at such a young age.
Oh, my Aaron. Yeah.
But were there issues during the show itself, or is this kind of a little bit later in life that it hit her, the problems?
It's a cautionary tale in that you have parents who get pretty smitten with show business. And see, Ron's parents didn't do that. They would take him home from a party fast, take him home, you know, make a normal life for him. Her parents got kind of carried away with all this. And I don't think she ever got a good education because you don't get a good enough education being yanked off the set down for a few hours of lessons and back onto the set. So she was a smart darling girl. It was a tragedy.
Is part of it, you think, because Ronnie's dad is, of course, with Rance Howard, who recently passed away, but because he was an actor himself, he kind of understood the pitfalls.
Yeah, absolutely. They raised him and his mother, also smart, wonderful, did an excellent job with Ron. Yeah.
Indeed. Henry Winkler, one of the things people forget, because, you know, you said it early on in the interview, the Fonz and whatever, and everybody thinks he's the star, and he did kind of become the star of the show. But you write about the fact in the early first year of the show, for example, we heard about as much from him as we heard from you.
That's right. He oftentimes had no lines at all. He would be in his little canvas windbreaker jacket, walk into the bathroom, take out his comb, see that his hair was perfect, just the way it was, and put the comb back, and he didn't need lines. He didn't need to say anything.
But that's where people got endeared to him, and of course he just grew in time. Do you get a sense at the end of the show that the show sort of, and this is a bit of a pun here, kind of jumped the shark, because, you know, there's that famous episode where the Fonz jumps the shark. Did you get a sense of like going, guys, I think we've done our time?
Oh, we all certainly knew that it was time, but we felt everybody cried. We cried the last two shows. We cried, it was very emotional because we'd been together for 11 seasons. Yeah. And the very next morning, we got up at 5 in the morning and flew to Okinawa to play softball with the U.S. Marines.
That's what you got to do to keep it going. You also wrote about how melancholy it was in the final show when Tom, as Howard, looks at the camera and basically thanks everybody.
Yes.
That was tough for you, wasn't it?
It was. We're all crying.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I remember that. But here's the good news. You write about this. At least you knew the end was there. A lot of people do a show and then find out, by the way, you're canceled. You knew.
No, we smelled it coming a whole long time, you know. Yeah,
I do have to ask you one question.
There is a natural 7-year lifespan for most shows.
Yeah.
So the fact that we squeezed out 4 more years, you know.
Ronnie Howard had to be, I mean, from and you write about him as Opie Taylor. He wrote the foreword to your book, and Richie Cunningham, now a director. What an amazing kid. He's not a kid. And I shouldn't call him Ronnie anymore. I know it's Ron. But what an incredible talent.
Well, it's a story, isn't it? He's got a very clean brain, very disciplined, he's Mr. Perfect. If he ever made a mistake, we just cheered. We went crazy because he never made a mistake, you know?
Yeah.
So he was in control of himself and knew what he wanted all along.
Can I ask you, can we clear something up that apparently Ronnie doesn't have the answer to?
What?
He wrote about it in the foreword. You apparently would look at him and grab his ears and tell him to tuck his ears.
Yes.
And he writes in the foreword that to this day he does not know if you were serious. Marion, clear it up. Were you serious?
When I said, Ron, now look, your ears stick out so bad. We can't get those fixed. We can see. No, I just do that to tease him.
I got such a kick out of it when
now he's very bald. He's quite bald.
Yeah.
So you see him in a beautiful array of hats.
I love it. How often, you know, for the remaining cast members, do you still get together? I know some of them do, because some of them do autograph shows. Are you a part of that, or how much are you seeing those guys, or your life has moved on to other things? I mean, I know you're in Gilmore Girls and other things.
No, Ron and his daughter, Bryce, just had a mutual birthday party, and we all went.
Oh, great.
It was hundreds of people there. It was a wonderful party, and so it was, everybody's pretty busy, so
right.
We don't get together too much. But I very often have lunch with Henry Winkler, and the Anson has been helping with my book, and so is Donnie Most with the MC the other night, and we had a wonderful event for the book, my book.
Yeah,
so we're a pretty close family when you consider.
Which is good.
And
please tell Anson I said hi, if you would.
I certainly will.
So what is, you've done Gilmore Girls. You're not retired. I mean, you're doing things. So let me ask you, what's next?
No. I am retired.
Come on.
Retired. Because I'm 89.
Years young.
I know I'm not. I'm not young. So I said, children, and the last play I did in Overland Park, and I said, you know, I'm tired. I think I quit. And they said, no, we'll make it easier for you. No. And I said, no, I quit. You know, and there is a time to quit. So that was a good decision.
Well, at least we get a culmination then, if you will, in your book called My Days, Happy and Otherwise. What a treat it is to read the candor of your life. You don't seem to pull any punches in it. And and that's what we want to know, right? We want to know what really went on and how you really feel, and no whitewashing, and that you don't do. So I sure hope people will read it. And, of course, you wrote it with the assistance of a man named David Laurel, so we want to give him credit as well. With a foreword by Ronnie Howard. I saw that. It was the first thing I read. I went, I got to read what Ronnie said.
great.
Which is so great.
So great.
But Marion Ross, congratulations on the book, and I'll say congratulations and a thank you for a career that just millions of people have enjoyed and continue to enjoy and will continue to enjoy, because fortunately the work that you have done will indeed live on forever, and that's pretty cool.
Well, I've loved talking to you, Paul. It's just wonderful. Thank you so much.
It is my pleasure. Hang with me, because we're going to go out with a little music that will be familiar to you. Marion Ross, the book is My Days, Happy and Otherwise. These days are on.